watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
as we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Change seems to be the watchword for the 2008 campaign season. Yet the candidates put forward as the leading contenders are put forward exactly because they can be relied upon to create continuity, not change, in the system that has been responsible for the converging environmental and economic crises coming upon us. 6 years ago on the show, I read an article titled Escaping the Matrix by Richard K. Moore of cyberjournal.org. It was one of the most popular shows of all times. That article became the basis of a book of the same title, Escaping the Matrix, which Moore published 2 years ago. I'm going to begin the program by reading you a recent article he wrote, published in last month's Global Research at globalresearch.ca, titled The Post-Bush Regime, A Prognosis, published December 27, 2007. Moore wrote, "In order to understand anything about American political affairs, it is necessary to have some understanding of who it is that really makes the decisions behind the scenes and what their interests are. In this way, we have some hope of identifying the hidden agendas being served by government actions and programs, and some hope of identifying the longer-term strategies that are at play. It turns out, and informed people should already know this, that the U.S. is essentially owned and managed by a small clique of wealthy families, the ones who own and control the Federal Reserve. The Rockefellers are the obvious and well-known members of this clique, but there are others less well-known, not all American, and some whose identity remains to this day a carefully guarded secret. We don't even know exactly who it is that's running the show. Such has been the nature of our, quote, democracy since 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act was snuck through Congress during Christmas recess by the same folks who funded Woodrow Wilson's campaign and who became the private owners of the new all-powerful central bank. The first major initiative of these folks, the ancestors of our current ruling clique, was to finance both sides in Europe during World War I, and then to connive the entrance of the U.S. into the war just in time to tilt the balance to the side favored by the clique, the same pattern that later characterized World War II. From that point forward, American policymaking has been firmly in the hands of the original Federal Reserve clique and its descendants. The mainstream media is also under the thumb of the same clique, so that public opinion is never allowed to interfere with fundamental clique objectives. The media can be used to support sitting presidents or to undermine them, depending upon which best enhances those objectives. No president who has turned on these people has survived long in office, as we saw most recently in the case of JFK. The tentacles of the clique reach also into the top echelons of the intelligence services and the Pentagon, and into those influential globalist forums such as the WTO, the Trilateral Commission, and the Bilderbergers. Bush and the neocons have been mere tools of the day for this clique. The neocons happened to be promoting a package that appeals to the clique, that promised to advance some of its objectives. In selecting the neocons to be the drivers behind a new administration, the clique was by no means adopting the neocon philosophy, nor were they buying into the whole PNAC package. They were simply employing a convenient tool that was aligned tactically with clique interests for the time being. Any such tool can be discarded whenever its behavior becomes counterproductive, or when a better tool comes along. There is always a plan B in the wings for any tool that might go rogue or go sour. Bush, who has probably never even read the PNAC agenda, and PNAC is the Project for a New American Century, a policy document that's a blueprint for U.S. world domination. Anyway, Moore says, Bush, who has probably never even read the PNAC agenda, was selected for entirely different reasons. Knowing that the agenda would be highly unpopular, the clique decided that defending it logically would be very difficult, even with complete control over the media. An articulate and intelligent president would look like a fool if he tried to defend the insane policies. So our clique slyly figured, why not put someone up there who is obviously a fool, right through to his whole little soul, so that the public will believe they are struggling against the foolishness of one man and have no understanding of what's really going on. Of course, Bush, being clueless on all matters apart from golf, looting, cocaine, and womanizing, would need to be kept far away from any role in running the White House. Hence, the need for Cheney, the shadow real president, who leaves all the photo ops to Bush, who stays out of the public eye himself, and who carries the black Armageddon box with him wherever he goes, something only official presidents have done in the past. This was the project that went operational in the form of Bush's initial presidential campaign. The ducks were all lined up for launching a major imperialist venture. The preparations for 9/11 were well underway, and no power on earth was going to stop the Bush show. Of course, Bush the Clueless was going to win, no matter how much vote-fixing and media lying was required, or how many Supreme Court justices were needed to accomplish the task. As a last resort, they wouldn't have hesitated to off-gore one of their own boys if it was the only way to open the path for their current man, a tactic they used earlier with Bobby Kennedy. Of course, now that we have Diebold machines, all of this can be accomplished by a single computer command message specifying which candidates are to get which percentage of votes in each precinct. Exit polls have been abandoned since they provide hard statistical evidence of the systematic fix. The neocons have accomplished much for their elite puppeteers and have been given in return free rein to loot at will, funneling all those billions for the Iraq war into their own corporate coffers and investment portfolios. They, for their part, have established the foundations of a fascist state in the U.S. and Canada, secured Iraq's oil reserves, built permanent forward mega bases in Iraq, successfully destabilized Iraq and prepared it for Balkanization, secured pipeline routes in Afghanistan, restored the profitable opium trade, and made progress toward achieving the first strike capability that will be needed when the time comes to take on Russia and China. Quite a bundle of major achievements in a very short time, indeed. But to our clique, the question always is, what have you done for me lately, sunshine? The neocon intention to bomb Iran was the point where the tool went sour and threatened to go rogue. Anyone who thought seriously about what bombing would lead to knew that an attack would quickly spiral out of anyone's control, given the advanced arms that Russia has supplied to a hot-headed Iran, and given the fact that the powder keg would involve a trigger-happy, nuclear-potent, clinically deranged Israel. Russia and China would, of course, be on ultra-high scrambled alert, poised to intervene with due force if the spiral crossed certain unspecified lines in the sand. The neocons knew this, and the clique knew this. Any attack on Iran, no matter how well planned, limited, and executed, would be playing Russian roulette with World War III. And I'm reading from The Post-Bush Regime, A Prognosis by Richard K. Moore. Continuing, the neocons were ready to take this step, to play the game, and they were in a very advanced stage in their preparations of both the military and the PSYOP variety. Quite obviously, they were not deterred by the possibility of all-out global nuclear war. This has nothing to do with Bush's pretended belief in revelations and the ascension of the elect, but rather with the neocons' evident belief that they were ready for the big one, copying a page directly out of Dr. Strangelove, with the neocons in the role of Jack D. Ripper. Unlike the demented SAC base commander, however, the neocons were forced to telegraph their moves, and the clique was not pleased with the scenario. They knew the first strike capability was not nearly ready, and Russian roulette is not a game they ever play. They play only when they hold all the top cards and own a controlling interest in the casino. So the time had come to pull the plug on the neocon tool. It was surprisingly easy to do. The first step, taken who knows how long ago, was to put the word discreetly to the Joint Chiefs that the Iran project is off, regardless of what orders might come from the White House or the black box. This news, of course, was to be kept in the room, as it surely was. Once the castle was thereby made secretly safe, it was a trivial matter to plant the seeds that would unravel the whole gone-sour, rogue-threatening neocon bandwagon. A simple but devastating intelligence announcement, a few whispers to key Bilderberger players that it was open season on the American contingent at the next meeting, and various other subtle and quite easy moves. It takes little, after all, to bring down a house of cards, particularly one propped up by a weak joker. The clique, as usual, remains invisible. Certain elements in the White House know what's happening by now, while others still seem to think the neocon agenda is the order of the day. It seems pretty obvious that Cheney was briefed in advance and has some kind of golden parachute in his Christmas stocking. I haven't heard a peep from him since we first learned of the clique reversal, when the intelligence announcement became public knowledge. Bush is by now imagining Cheney as a reincarnated Judas and practicing how to say, "E tu, Brute," if the opportunity arises. And yet Bush evidently still hasn't caught on that his chip has been turned off, him and that fellow Gates, both of whom still act as if the tractor is still in gear. I guess they'll go down like the fellow in the Monty Python film. Go ahead, cut off my other arm. I'll still beat you. What happens next will be ratcheting in gains and preparing a fresh new storyline. That is to say, none of the very impressive, i.e. horrific, achievements of the neocons will be undone, and yet the American people will be led to believe that the evils are in the past, the same standard tactic that we saw work so well when Nixon resigned. The media will be filled with fresh new storylines, along with bright, intelligent, confident, reassuring, empathetic, earth-loving new faces, plus other new fantasies, and the Bush experience will fade from public memory, along with last season's football scores. Such an advantage it is for our rulers that we Americans have such tiny memory spans and such limited powers of independent observation compared to the rest of the world's population. I guess the purpose of the melting pot was to melt away our basic intuitive judgment. It is not quite the time for the surprise attack on the wicked witches of the East. Space-based warfare is still in beta test, nor is it necessary to proceed at the moment with the full unleashing of the Gestapo, the SS stormtroopers, concentration camps, forced labor, and the whole nine yards. The neocons have diligently built the foundations for all of this, both in concrete and in legal precedent. But the project is for the moment on hold and the neocons off mission. When the time comes to resume the project, that will be perceived as a new response to an unexpected emergent scenario, and no deferred continuity with the Bush era will be noticed. I suggest that we can see the focus of the next U.S. administration by paying attention to Al Gore. He's going around preaching the gospel of climate change, and that is rapidly becoming the new cause célèbre for the international community. It's more than a campaign by Gore. We're seeing a campaign being supported by the mass media, by the powers that be. We are clearly being prepared for a new show after the Bush show. And the new show is going to be about carbon taxes and credits, new energy sources, more efficient cars, biofuels, and all those other things that are allegedly related to climate change and peak oil. In order to clear the way for the new show, it seems pretty clear that the new administration will begin with some easy political wins by rapidly cleaning up some obvious messes left by the neocons. Closing down Guantanamo and declaring that rendition flights have been abandoned would gain a lot of points at no real cost. Secret flights and prisons would undoubtedly continue. Iraq has already been destabilized and prepared for balkanization, and permanent U.S. bases have already been built. Another easy win will be for U.S. troops to withdraw to their bases and the oil fields, for the war to be declared over, and for Iraq to be split up into ethnic provinces, leaving them to squabble among themselves. It can all be portrayed in the media as a victory for peace and democracy. What, then, can we expect from this new show? What consequences are likely to follow from implementing the kind of policies that Al Gore and the media have been talking about around climate change, energy independence, etc.? What is our ruling clique really trying to accomplish? At a general level, it is clear that those kinds of policies do not involve fundamental changes in how our societies operate. We'll still have cars, only they might be a bit more efficient, and we'll be paying more for fuel and taxes to operate them. We'll still be shipping products from China that we could produce locally, and we'll still be depending on long-distance trucking. We'll still be using agricultural methods that are highly petroleum-dependent for tractors, fertilizers, and pesticides. Research and development of new energy sources will lead to lots of government subsidies, and it may get us a bit more energy, but not nearly enough to replace petroleum. As long as our transport and other infrastructures remain basically unchanged, we remain unsustainable, dependent on petroleum, and none of the Gore-like initiatives change the overall energy picture, carbon picture, or climate picture in any significant way. In order to begin figuring out what the real agenda is behind Gore-like policies, let's look first at one example, biofuels. Producing biofuels does give us another energy source, but it also removes land from food production. As a consequence of the already existing biofuels market, market prices for grain and other potential biofuels are now being driven by energy prices. Global food prices are therefore rising rapidly, while at the same time food production acreage is being reduced. These two things will directly and drastically increase world hunger and starvation, particularly in the poorest regions. A Gore-inspired administration will be promoting an expansion of biofuel programs on a global scale, and it will be patting itself on the back for its noble oil-saving deeds. All of this will be occurring in a context where we are facing a global food crisis generally. We haven't seen many headlines on this topic, but the world is sitting on the brink of a major food crisis. Emergency stockpiles are at low ebb, production levels are down, crop failures are up, etc. It's a very nasty picture, even without biofuels. In this context, the net consequence of a major biofuel agenda comes down to international genocide. in order to provide marginally more fuel to the overconsuming industrialized nations, untold millions will starve in the third world, in addition to those untold millions that are already starving. The marginal energy gain is so small by comparison that we must accept that the biofuels agenda is primarily about genocide. However, when we begin reading about new famines breaking out, perhaps in Brazil, where the biofuels are now going into massive production, the headlines will blame it on droughts or crop failures or some other excuse, as they always do. We will meanwhile feel a green glow every time we fill up our Prius with biofuels, unaware of what damage we are doing, and perhaps we'll donate to Oxfam or adopt some third world child and send them letters. I'm reading from The Post-Bush Regime, A Prognosis by Richard K. Moore. A Gore agenda is simply genocidal imperialism hiding under a new mask, a new show. Instead of killing off the Indians by killing their buffalo, it kills off populations by removing their access to food in other ways. Once again, they must be sacrificed so that our way of life can continue and expand. We might note here that more Iraqis died under Bill Clinton's sanctions than have been killed in the current Iraq war. In Bill Clinton's time, the pattern was invisible genocide, rather than the more violent Bush variety. Apparently, in Hillary Clinton's time, we are to return to that earlier invisible pattern. Clearly, the consequences of a Gore agenda are genocidal, but one might question whether that is a primary intended outcome. I've been suggesting that it is, and I think more elaboration is in order on that point. I haven't made the case very well yet. I've merely presented some of the evidence and suggested a pattern. In order to get a proper perspective on this issue, we need to step back a bit and consider the bigger picture of the industrialized world vis-à-vis the third world in the face of a broad range of mounting resource shortages, the strategic perspective of our ruling clique. It seems very clear that the industrialized nations have no intention of changing the basic path they are on or of abandoning capitalism. We can expect only more industrial growth, more energy consumption, continued use of energy-intensive agricultural methods, etc. The energy band-aids of a Gore agenda make no significant difference in this picture whatever. They simply affirm the intention to proceed with business as usual. The only way the industrialized North can continue on this path is by taking over more and more of the Third World's land, water, and resources for its own use. As the industrial appetite for resources continues to grow at a rapid rate, and as our global resources are increasingly stressed, we are going to see a very rapid expansion of Third World hunger and starvation, the globalization of African-scale famines. This is inevitable while the North stays on this basic path. Whether we have Gore-like policies or some other set of policies is of little consequence. The inevitability, quote-unquote, of mass die-offs in the Third World is well known to those who run the industrial nations. From the perspective of the heights of power, the question becomes, how can we manage these die-offs so that they cause the least disruption to the global economy, and so that they don't arouse too much public outcry? Of course, once you begin managing die-offs, you are then engaging in genocide, i.e., arranging for particular populations to die in preference to others. The pattern for the management strategy has been made very clear in sub-Saharan Africa, where all those civil wars, genocidal atrocities, droughts, and famines have been occurring. Not many people realize that these disasters have been systematically imposed on Africa by means of IMF requirements, covert destabilization programs, denial of medical care, the widespread distribution of automatic weapons, the manipulations of international banks, the dedication of agricultural land and water to northern consumption, and the list goes on. Not only is Africa being starved to death by market forces, but the process is being accelerated by covert genocidal interventions. In Africa, we see a full-scale Holocaust, a massive genocide program in process. Or should I say, we see it not. For in the media, there's nothing like that. We read that tribal conflicts have flared up, but we don't hear about the two CIA bombings that were each blamed on the other side and which ignited the fracas, a fracas that could become a civil war. We read about a famine due to drought, and we aren't told that there would be plenty of water if it weren't for all the coffee export plantations using up the local water. We don't see genocide. We see Africans befallen with unfortunate miseries, all due to the vagaries of Mother Nature. Thus, the pattern of managing die-offs becomes clear. It has been tested satisfactorily in Africa, and we can expect the proven pattern to be employed in the future. They pick a population that they consider redundant. They undertake a program of acquiring that population's resources. And then, to speed up the process of removal, they engage in various covert acts of genocide. In this way, the world's population can be whittled down piecemeal and manageably, as the North gradually requires the utilization of all the world's resources for its own exclusive use. Unfortunately for the North, even that won't be enough to enable industrial growth to continue. The South is being killed off, only that the unsustainable North can continue on its path a wee bit longer. Meanwhile, the media in the North paints a picture in which only nature causes famines, and the role of the North is always to provide aid to the extent it can. Concerned viewers are given convenient numbers to call, so they can dispel their concern with a simple donation that will save a child or give a family a goat. No genocide around here, we're the good guys. See no evil, feel just fine. By the way, too bad about those famines over there. The Gore-style policies are not just genocidal, they are formidably genocidal. When they start taking massive amounts of land out of food production and bring about a substantial increase in global food prices, in the face of an already stressed world food situation, they could bring about, in a very short time, one bad harvest season, famine on a scale we have never seen before. How serious the outcome will be depends entirely on how aggressively the new administration pursues the Gore-style agenda. They've got genocide down to a science with tunable parameters. Apparently, having field-tested Holocaust tactics in sub-Saharan Africa, a decision has been made to go global with the program. For this purpose, the Gore-style policies have the potential to be the appropriate weapon of mass destruction, the equivalent in the starvation game to nukes in the kill-by-fire game. This decision to go global was evidently made some time ago, no doubt just before Gore was asked to make an inconvenient truth. The film was the first signal of which way the winds were going to blow, the first preview of the new show. The primary mission of the Hillary administration, under the banners of doing something about climate change and peak oil, will evidently be to undertake a massive resource grab in the global South, leading to the selective and massive elimination of certain populations through starvation. In other words, the mission is to expand the starving Africa model globally, a process that will presumably be helped along by the usual shadowy suspects in their usual destabilizing roles. My big fear with the Bush regime was a likely attack on Iran, or was it the unleashing of the Gestapo? It was a close race in those dark days. Now we are on the verge of a regime bent on genocide on a scale that would put the Nazis to shame. I suggest that we have escaped the kettle only to fall into the frying pan. I hope no one out there has any romantic notions about the new administration, and I hope everyone realizes that the political process can never be used to solve our problems. That system is in fact the heart of our problem. I also hope it is clear to everyone that global genocide is an inevitable consequence of the continuation of this insane capitalist system, whether you agree with most of my analysis or not. And in the end, capitalism can't last anyway. Only when you have reached that deep level of hopelessness, where you see no avenue of escape, can you clear your mind enough to begin to see where the real problem lies. The real problem lies, my friends, in the fact that you and I have nothing to say about how our societies are run. Any one of us has more sense than the people who are running things, and we certainly have our fellow human beings more at heart. Our problem lies in our own powerlessness, leaving power in the hands of those who always abuse it, in one way or another, in one age after another. Our challenge as a sentient species, and our response if we seek to do anything about the growth through genocide agenda, is to begin to empower ourselves, us ordinary people, without reference to the useless political process. How to pursue our empowerment must be the aim of our investigations, and pursuing that empowerment must be the point of our activism. I have just read you an article by Richard K. Moore titled "The Post-Bush Regime: A Prognosis," published in Global Research, December 27, 2007. Richard Moore is the author of Escaping the Matrix, and you can find out more about his work at escapingthematrix.org. Global Research, an excellent publication with many interesting articles, is at globalresearch.ca. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Malachy Telek is a singer-songwriter from Fair Isle, Shetland. He heard a radio news feature about whether the last remaining British veteran of World War I to die should be given a state funeral. He wrote this song from the perspective of the last veteran who has seen his country betray all of the ideals that he held.
90 years go by like clouds in an autumn sky, like words lost in endless conversations. In dreams we build our perfect worlds, our hearts made strong, fingers curled round stones cast from our imaginations. Some stones never crumble or collide, as from our dreams they're torn. With these stones I have traveled all my life, I'm still holding on. I've stood with men in fields of mud, trenches filled with piss and blood. I've felt the burn of tears, perspiration. I've seen friends and brothers die, remember every crime that I committed in the name of my nation. Sometimes I wonder what it's worth, this world that I must leave. A 'cause all our hopes are squandered and destroyed in emptiness and greed. When I lay down in that cold ground, I don't want a flag wrapped around me. When I lay down in that cold, cold ground, I'm not a superstitious man. I've always done the best I can, and I've never had a God to light my way. But I kept my faith in fellow men, swore I would never fight again, 'cause nothing is worth the sacrifice we gave. Say we cannot forget those brave souls who fought their country's cause. It's them who must remember what was lost in their war to end all wars. When I lay down in that cold ground, I don't want their flag wrapped around me. When I lay down in that cold ground, I don't want their flag around me. When I lay down in that cold, cold ground.
We'll continue the thread opened by Richard Moore with a talk given by UK scholar Nafiz Ahmed, author of The War on Truth, 9/11 Disinformation and the Anatomy of Terrorism, as well as other books on the geopolitics behind the war on terrorism. In this talk titled The Hidden Holocaust, Our Civilizational Crisis, he applies his rigorous research to the broad canvas of what we like to call Western civilization. Unfortunately, the microphone was not well placed, so the sound is not as clear as it should be. You'll have to listen closely. I promise it will be worth the effort. This talk was given at the end of November in London and comes to us courtesy of Chris at Sheffield Indymedia.
Good evening, everyone. I'd just like to begin by extending my thanks to the Imperial Alpha Beta Society for taking the time and the trouble for organising this event for me and for the Institute of Policy Research and Development. I'm also going to kind of beg your forgiveness because in my chair's introduction you mentioned that we'd be focusing a lot on issues pertaining to the global social justice movement. And in the course of actually preparing, there is a preponderance of doom and gloom and looking at what's going wrong with the world, and only a little bit at the end talking about the positive things that we can do, but hopefully in the Q&A session we'll be having an opportunity to talk about that. So I'm going to start by kind of focusing on the title that we've got, The Idea of the Holocaust, which, as we all know, is traditionally used to refer to the systematic, bureaucratic, state-sponsored persecution and mass murder of the Jews by Nazi Germany during the Second World War. As you can see, the word Holocaust is originally a Greek word, which means sacrifice by fire. It conveys an event, the scale and horror of which transformed the course of world history, as we're all aware. Moreover, it's often seen as a crime against humanity that is unparalleled and unique. This, none of us dispute. The Nazi Holocaust was indeed a uniquely horrific genocide, whose enormity and systematic character is barely imaginable. In this context, you might want to know What do I mean when I talk about hidden Holocaust? That's the title of today's event. But I'm not using the term in a strict academic sense at the moment. I'm trying to use it to convey the sense of what's going on today, what's been going on in our history. What you might kind of see is a campaign of global homicide, whose scale and enormity is very, very difficult to convey in words. I also use the term hidden Holocaust specifically to convey the idea that this campaign is actually hidden from our perceptions. It's something that is not very easy to see. It's less visible. It's something that if you want to understand it, you need to scratch the surface of what's going on, not just today, but also historically. Its reality, though, is very real. Very real for millions of people around the world, both historically and today. But it remains officially unacknowledged. I'm going to focus on the 20th and 21st centuries in terms of talking about how this hidden historical Holocaust is now escalating into a global Holocaust, even as we speak. I'm going to talk about expert projections from different disciplines in the social sciences and physical sciences on the really, really worrying trends that are going on now, which may even culminate, according to some of the most prominent experts, culminate in the extinction of our species, and perhaps even all life on Earth. And this is where we get to the second part of my title, our civilizational crisis. That picture's real, by the way. No, I'm just kidding, it's not. It's a fake picture. So civilization is a word that's kind of bandied about a lot. And it's often used to explain the dynamics of the war on terror. And I've got a quote here from Tony Blair earlier this year, where he's used the term. And actually, his use of the term came from an academic theory of international relations. You've probably heard of it, the Clash of Civilizations thesis, that was originally put forward by Samuel Huntington, who was a Harvard professor and a government advisor, who said that, you know, the war on terror is basically an almost inevitable clash between these two civilizational camps, you know, Islam and West. And what Tony Blair has done is really kind of just amended this a little bit, but really kind of solidified the meaning to say that it's not just a case of you've got these two civilizations on an equal playing field now kind of inevitably confronting. Is that one of these civilizations represents this reactionary, semi-feudal, backward existence, whereas our civilization represents progress, modernity. But my argument today is that this hidden Holocaust that I'm talking about is not an aberration from our advanced civilization that represents, you know, like the peak of human development. On the contrary, I'm arguing that this hidden Holocaust is integral to the very structure of the values and activities of this civilization as it currently stands. And unless we attempt to transform the nature of this civilization, we may well perish in a Holocaust of our own making. So I'm going to have a bit of a history lesson here. I want to start with looking at the Holocaust in history. When did it start? And why and how? Well, it started at the beginning of what you might see in modern civilization itself. The origins of modern civilization can be found to some extent in the voyages of European colonial expansion and trade from around the 15th century all the way to the 19th century. It was a very disparate process. Different powers died at different times. You had so many different countries involved: Spain, Italy, the Portuguese, the English. Many other explorers ventured out from their home countries in search of new wealth and new land in all corners of the globe. They went to the continents of America, Africa, and Asia. They set up colonies, they set up trading outposts. Now these guys, these colonists, these settlers, they had all sorts of intentions. Some of them had money, and they wanted to invest it. They wanted to find new opportunities. Others, they had lives of real hardship in their home countries, and they were looking for something different. They wanted a fresh start. Others wanted to deliver the message of Christianity to these native populations. But almost all of them identified what they were doing with this inexorable march of progress. They saw themselves as spreading a distinctive form of development to other parts of the world, bringing the fruits of European civilization to what were kind of automatically seen as backward peoples. And whatever the intentions, European expansion involved massive systematic violence. It involved violence of all kinds. And I've got a quote there from a well-known historian who just observes that colonialism, as it was conducted in history, was invariably linked with genocide. Genocide was almost systematically linked with colonialism. This wasn't the result of some grand plan. Sorry, not sure what that is. But it was the result of very, very kind of haphazard interests which faced resistance from native populations. I'm briefly going to go through a couple of examples of what happened in our history. Starting with the continent of America, which we know the year 1492, when Columbus originally ventured out and he was reputed to have discovered the continent. Now, between the 15th and 18th centuries, the Spanish and also the English, as well as the French and a number of other different European countries, began to encroach further and further inland into America. And in the course of attempting to control that country, that continent, they created huge devastation. Whole civilizations collapsed as a direct consequence of colonization. There's a number of studies that have explored this issue, and I've got that one book there, which was a landmark book by David Standard, who is a historian in the United States. And this is how he described it. He said, at the dawn of the 15th century, Spanish conquerors and priests presented the Indians they encountered with a choice. Either give up your religion and culture and land and independence, swearing allegiance as vassals to the Catholic Church and the Spanish crown, or suffer, and he quotes, all the mischief and damage, unquote, that the European invaders choose to inflict upon you. And I've given a ballpark figure there, but I mean, the breakdown of the figures is really huge. I mean, 11 million people lost their lives in Mexico, the Andean Empire of the Incas, you had 8 million Native Americans lost their lives, the Portuguese conquest in north of Mexico took 2.5 million lives, and the list goes on and on. 50 million is probably the most reliable figure. 100 million is slightly more speculative. Now, moving to another continent, I focused on the impact of the slave trade. Now, obviously, the slave trade did exist in Africa before the Europeans went there, but it didn't exist on the systematic and global scale which it came to once the Europeans basically took control of the coastal areas of Africa and began shipping out dozens and dozens and dozens of Africans day by day. This really lasted a long, long, it was a protracted period of 5 centuries. And there's a lot of debate over how many people actually died in this process. But Rummel, R.J. Rummel, is one of these scholars who has this penchant, this deep passion for statistics. If you look at his book, Death by Government, it's literally just a compendium of statistics of governments that have basically killed people. And it's a really, really harrowing read, but he's very, very meticulous. And that's his estimate, that in 5 centuries, you had a minimum of 17 million Africans dying. Now, the way they died, obviously, was different. A number of Africans were killed in the process of the colonialists trying to basically enforce them into the slave trade. The second way in which they died was when they were transported across the Atlantic Ocean in these really, really harsh conditions. They didn't have access to food, didn't have access to water. They were basically suffering from diseases, and they weren't cared for whatsoever. Millions of people died on that journey alone. Finally, once they arrived in the American continent, they were worked to death on largely cotton plantations and other kind of enterprises. And the important thing that I would like us to remember about this process is its systematic character. Many of the people involved in this were not evil people. They didn't set out to be evil, but they accepted what they were doing because they had these elaborate ideologies of justification. And this is what is very worrying, is that really terrible things often happen with the best of intentions. The other thing I want us to remember is how this contributed to civilization. There's a sociologist at the University of Essex by the name of Robert Blackburn, who did a study of the relationship between the emergence of capitalism and industrialization and slavery. This was an old argument that people will still be debating now, but he argued that the profits of slavery between Europe, Africa, and America contributed fundamentally to Britain's industrialization. He said the profits from the trade for 1770 would have provided between 20 to 55% of Britain's gross fixed capital formation, which was then invested in industrialization. That is a very, very disturbing allegation, because it suggests, again, that violence, systematic violence, was somehow integral to our development, to our advancement. This is no less true than for the example of India. Again, not very well known, but there was a landmark study that was done by a British historian here by the name of Mike Davis, published in 2001 called Late Victorian Holocausts. And what he did, he showed how British imperial free market policies in India converted climatic events in South Asia, consisting of droughts, and also South Africa, into these really, really deadly famines. The droughts certainly would have led to deaths on a small scale. I think that's me. But it would not have led to this massive systematic scale of death. And he uses India as one of his prominent case studies, and he argues that between 5.5 and 12 million people died in what was essentially an artificially induced famine, where millions of tons of grain were actually in commercial circulation. He shows that India had basically become this satellite country for Britain's industrialization. Britain was industrializing. They needed to, most of the agricultural land was now being used for industry. So they needed to have more imports for food. And so India became this basically the source of food. It fed England. And what he says is basically Londoners were in effect eating India's bread. Just to give you an example, between 1877 and 1878, grain merchants exported a record 6.4 million hundredweights of wheat to Europe, while millions of Indian poor starved to death. So Davis's conclusion is again very harrowing, very worrying. He says that these people didn't kind of die as some kind of accident of history. Many British officials knew what was going on. He goes through the documents. He gives quote after quote of officials, colonial administrators, justifying the mass death of Indians at that time. So he concludes that these people didn't die outside the modern world system. They died as part of the emergence of this world system. So my argument is that this violence was not merely accidental to the European imperial project. It was integral to it. And by that, I don't mean that European settlers and colonists kind of set out to become murderous killers. Of course they didn't, by no means. As I said, many of them set out with the best of intentions. But in the course of their imperial projects, murderous killing became increasingly necessary if the interests of European colonies were to be sustained. When the natives increasingly resisted European interference to exert control over their land, colonists responded with force. And this system basically accelerated between 1870 and 1914, when you've heard of the scramble for Africa, where there was a kind of renewed lease of life given to these colonial imperatives. During that period, almost the entire world essentially came under the control of the European empires. Britain, France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Belgium, the USA, and Japan. Just as an example, between themselves, in Africa, for example, They acquired 30 new colonies and 110 million subjects. I've given just one example there of how this impacted economically in a global scale. People talk about globalization. Globalization began in this process. It was a long historical process. It wasn't something that just began in the 1970s, as we're often kind of told. It was something that began many centuries ago. And this, we can see even features of it that we criticize now, we can see features of it going on then. And the examples I gave there is per capita income for developed Europe compared to the colonies. In 1880, Europe had double the per capita income of most of the South or the Third World. By 1913, it was three times as much, and by 1950, it was five times as much. Similarly, the per capita share of GNP in the industrialized countries of the developed European core was in 1830 already twice as much, already double. By 1913, it became seven times as high. So this was a system which fundamentally marginalized and subjugated certain parts of the world to the interests of the European core. Now, fast track. We skip the Second the World War, we fast track to 1945, the end of the Second World War, and the dawn of a new post-war international order. Now, obviously, as the Second World War was coming to an end, people were thinking that the United States, in particular, as well as Britain, were kind of thinking, what are we going to do once we... They thought they would win the war, pretty much. They knew they had overwhelming military strength. They were trying to think, how would we reconstruct the post-war international order? And so what you have here, I've got a photo there of the Council on Foreign Relations and a little logo from the State Department. And in the 1940s, the State Department got together with the Council on Foreign Relations and they started thinking how they were going to do this. They got together the academics and the policymakers and started laying down their plans. And pretty much, they consciously decided that the order that they would construct would actually be an imperial order. And the interesting thing is that today, I mean, most politicians today would not know this. They wouldn't be aware of this. They would just be like, how could you say that this is an imperial system? But in the 1940s, they knew they were designing an imperial system. They were doing it consciously. Some of them may have even had some good intentions. But pretty much what they were thinking about was how to maintain US power at this particular time. And I want to give a couple of other quotes just to give you an idea of how this worked. Grand area strategy was basically premised on this idea that if you wanted to maintain global control, there were certain areas of the world that you needed to dominate. If you didn't dominate those areas, you wouldn't have global control. So you identify these areas, and that area, but overall, was called the grand area.